I'm Sean O'Banion.
And I'm Shannon Mullen. This is Character.
Conversation about actors, their craft, and some of their unforgettable roles in movies and shows we love.
Our guest is a writer, director, and an Emmy Award-winning actor, despite his best efforts to avoid that path early in his career.
He's been performing for more than 40 years, on stage from Broadway to the West End, and on the big screen in everything from low-budget indie movies to massive blockbuster franchises.
Not to mention hundreds of episodes of television on more than 70 series, ranging from The Affair and Ballers to House of Lies and The Good Doctor, and one episode of Doogie Howser, M.D. back in the day. But he's best known for the supporting role that earned him that Emmy, an iconic character he brought to life in the NBC series The West Wing.
Richard Schiff, welcome to Character.
Well, it's a pleasure to join you.
How refreshing.
I wanted to sort of dive right into the movie that you and I worked on together, The Automatic Hate. Mm.
This, for people who haven't seen it, which is probably most people, it's an independent film. It's a drama. It premiered at South by Southwest in 2015, I think it was, directed by Justin Lerner, who co-wrote it with Catherine O'Brien. It stars Joseph Cross, Adelaide Clemens, stars Richard, and Ricky Jay, the late Ricky Jay, plays your brother. We never got to talk about it when it was shooting, but I was curious, you know, when you first read that script, because it's a very complicated little movie. It's I guess the easiest way to say it is that it's about a family with some very dark secrets in their past.
I'm remembering the battle between the brothers. Is it incestual?
Ricky had a relationship with your sister.
Yes. Okay. So my son goes and finds my brother's family.
Right. Sort of against your wishes.
Very much against my wishes. And then brings the family together again. And he falls for his first cousin.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's okay. No, I'm kidding. and it's a very, very interesting film.
I was a co-producer on it, and I never really got a chance to ask you, when you first read that script, what did you think of it?
Well, it was shot in Oneonta, New York, which is a very short distance to Cooperstown, New York, and I've never been to the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Uh-huh. That's how we got you.
The truth comes out.
That was a little perk of doing the film. Honestly, the way that sometimes you choose to do a movie is it something you can do without sacrificing other work that you've already committed to? All of those kinds of things. But the script has to be at least potentially layered enough to draw my interest. The themes of this film having to do with what's acceptable or what's morally appropriate, and the battle of family, you know, is something I understand. The reasons why families break up and the reasons why brothers who are torn apart by the actions of one or the other is fascinating. You know, it's the nature of what is happening in this country as on a larger scale as we speak. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what is it that causes that to happen that is irreparable? And what happens in this case when somebody goes the extra effort to try to bring that schism back together again? Those are great themes to explore in a movie. Mm. You know, everything's about family. The West Wing was about family. It was just a family, you know, the flawed but functional. And, you know, you had your parent figures in the president, Bartlett and Leo, and then you had the children, you know, CJ and Josh and Toby and Sam, and how that family supported each other, how it fought with each other, was the story of that series.
Oh, we have so many things about the West Wing that we want to
talk. Yeah, we do have to talk about the West Wing. I did want to back up for a second, though, because you're a middle child, is that right?
Yes.
In talking about family and talking about the Automatic Hate and the relationship with brothers, did that inform your interest in performing, even in directing, and having sort of control over things?
Whatever the causes of me feeling like an outsider and being a middle child certainly contributed to that in ways, I guess. But, you know, when you feel left out and you feel that you're not being seen or understood, you probably go into a fantasy world, you know, and that's probably what I did. I don't know how different I was from other kids, you see, but and nor did I imagine myself, you know, singing songs from Oklahoma on a Broadway stage. You know, I didn't fantasize about being an actor. But what I loved about stories is that they took me away from whatever discomfort or pain I was feeling, you know, as a human being, as a young human. And it was that trance that fascinated me. And then I became just scientifically fascinated with what causes one to go into a trance and what a gift that is if you can do that for people. And so I've always fallen for those stories in which I am taken into a trance. And it's why when I'm watching movies with my family, and then they get on their phones and they start, you know, and somebody talks, and it's like, no, you just fucked up the trance. Now the play's got to start all over again.
There's almost no one I can watch movies with. Sean will attest to this. No one seems to be a safe companion for watching without texting,
no,
or talking or looking at their Apple Watch, getting up and going to the bathroom,
exactly,
or something.
So much so for me that I don't like, I used to love to go to the theater alone and to movies alone so that no one would talk to me for 2 hours after the event. So that, you know, hey, what do you think? Like, yeah, I don't know. The thing's still like swimming around in my blood. Let me alone for a minute, you know?
Yes.
That trance is what drew me to eventually finding my way into a theater and acting program at City College in New York.
So you started out being sort of the person who's orchestrating that trance, and then you move into becoming the person who's, you know, creating it in the moment. And I'm curious how you ended up finding out that that was what you needed to lean into.
Well, it's kind of a long story, so I'm going to make it as short as I can.
Okay.
I tripped and fell into a training, professional training program at City College called the Davis Center, with a man named Earl Gister, who was running that program. He had come from Carnegie Mellon for 3 years, stopover, on his way to run the Yale School of Drama for the next 20 years after that. So he was the top of his, you know, field. And I was doing a theater class. I'd taken an acting class, and then I was just for, you know, to see, just for fun, just because, it also brought me into interaction with other people, and particularly females. I wasn't experiencing that very often in my life. I was a recluse and very quiet. And so I liked that part of it. It scared the living daylights out of me, but I liked it. And then I was asked to audition for this professional training program. And I thought, wow, they must just be getting started if they need people. And sure enough, I auditioned with Little Murders by Jules Pfeiffer. And it's a funny monologue, but I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And they would laugh and I would stop and look at them, and, you know, like, what are you doing? I'm trying to read here. After it was over, Earl Gister, the first thing he said is, why are you so nervous? And I said, because I've never done this before. And he goes, well, why do you want to be an actor? And it's a 3-year professional training program. And I said, I don't really want to be an actor. And he said, well, what are you doing here? And I said, I don't really know. I write, so maybe it'll help my writing. He became my mentor and let me into the program. And a couple of years later, I'm sitting in his office, and I used to smoke his Lucky Strikes, and I'd bring him a big tub of coffee from the cafeteria. And we'd talk politics and theater, and he was an avant-garde theater guy from the 60s, and fascinating man. And at one point I said, by the way, why did you let me into this program? And he laughed and he goes, it's a good question. And he said, of all the years I've been doing this, I had never experienced someone so honest in the interview. And so I thought I'd take a chance. So I fell into this acting program and freaking hated it. I was so terrified. And then the second year, this woman named Rhea Geisner, who was from the Open Theater with Sam Shepard and all those people, fascinating. And I acted a little bit more. And then the third year was an acting teacher named Robert Macbeth, of all things. And he was a fascinating 6'5" former basketball player who was a theater guy, founded the New Lafayette Theater in Harlem. And Last I heard, he was homeless, living in Miami, but a fascinating man. And we used to sit and talk, and I'd smoke his Tarotins. Inside, we used to smoke. But anyway, I got out of there. I did one play, Blues for Mr. Charlie, James Baldwin play in Brooklyn, paying gig, my first audition. I got the lead role, and I had to get to the theater at noon in order to warm out my fears. And, you know, to start doing exercises and yoga and voice. And, you know, it took me 7 hours to relax enough to get on stage. You know, I had nothing but good responses, but it was just, I thought I'd be dead if I did another play, you know? So I gave it up and started seeking out assistant director jobs. And I started a theater company with other cab drivers in New York. And we started to find spaces, and I would direct plays because I wanted to stay in it somehow. You know, I didn't know what I was doing. And at some point, all these actors that I really loved had a teacher in common, and it was William Esper. This is after quite a few years. And so I called William Esper, and who was considered a master acting teacher in America, and said, can I talk to you? You know, all your actors are the ones I love to work with. And he said, sure. And I came in and I said, what is it that you do that makes your actors directable and also, you know, just great? And we talked for 45 minutes. And at the end of it, he goes, well, you're an interesting fellow. You should take my class. And I said, I don't want to be an actor. And he goes, you should take my class anyway. So I ended up doing a 2-year program with him. And every month or so, he would say, you know, Richard, you can do this. And I would say, yeah, but I don't want to be an actor. And then even I would go and audition with my partners for agents, and the agents would take me outside kind of quietly and go, we want to sign you. And I would say, I don't want to be an actor. And they would go, well, if you ever change your mind. And of course, when I changed my mind a few years later, I didn't remember who these people were. And so it took me like 6 years to find an agent like everybody else. And, you know, the end of that second year is when I finally committed to this idea of performance. And then we produced a play together, and I had a lead role in this play, and it was a hit. And that's when I finally caught it. But I've always been terrified by it. I don't like it very much, especially in theater. I find it terrifying. But that's my Everest. You know, I climb that mountain every time I do a play. I feel at home now on a film set, and I try to stir up the energy because it's not enough conflict on the set. You know, so
I think I remember that from The Automatic Hate. I do.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. It can get me in trouble.
I've got to grab something you said and go back to it just because it's part of the DNA of what we want to do with this show. Mm. That you said that the guy who told you in all the years he'd been doing this, you were more honest than anyone else in that first conversation. Mm. And honesty is breathtakingly and paradoxically rare, I think, the longer I spend in this business, trying to be in this business. And you talked about that too in terms of sort of the one thing you cannot take is being asked to do something dishonest with a character. What we're looking at exploring is that sort of the connection between an actor's humanity and the characters they play. Is it too obvious for me to say that that's why you've gone on to have the career that you've had, is because you started from a place of truth, because that honest person is who you are?
I think so. It wasn't like I said to myself, hey, you know what? If I'm honest, they'll notice me. You know, it's just that I had no other choice. That's been a thing to live by for me since I was young. And it's always gotten me in trouble as much as it has gotten me success of some kind. People don't like to hear the truth necessarily, and when you insist upon it, it causes
punishment, flogging, being outcast, having walls put up in your way, marginalization.
to name a few. You know, and it also, you run into hacks, and you run into people who aren't interested in the least in finding out. In climbing Everest, you know, they want to fly over it, take a bus around it, and I don't understand that. So run into conflict. Because this business is full, whether it's theater or, I mean, I did a play on the West End where that was an issue. And I was like, how is this possible? It's England. You're not supposed to be this trite in England. Being truthful is not an easy path. Let's put it that way. But all I can say is the work that I responded to that put me in a trance was work that was honest, because as soon as it's dishonest, the trance is broken. Old movies that I would stay up till 4 a.m. and watch back when I was an insomniac teenager who never went to school, those are the movies I found, you know, old Bogart movies and Spencer Tracy and, you know, Paul Muni and Katharine Hepburn and Barbara Stanwyck and Gary Cooper, you know, the movies of Frank Capra and Billy Wilder and all those great films from the old days. And I would forget that I wasn't sleeping and it was 4 a.m. School was the next day. And, you know, Danny Kaye from The Court Jester, you know, all these great old films. When I started going to plays, you know, the ones that were not truthful, I'd leave. Unless there was someone really cute on stage. If it's a dramatic play, I'm not going to come back in the second act. You know, if it's a lie, it's like, why?
You know, the fundamental disappointment to me about people who don't get that is that I think it's in all of us. I came across a Ralph Waldo Emerson quote that I thought you would appreciate. He said, "The one thing in the world of value is the active soul. The active soul sees absolute truth and utters truth or creates. In this action, it is genius. Not the privilege of here and there a favorite, but the sound estate of every man." You know, and I think that people are desperate for the truth, but we try so hard not to tell it to one another. You know, that baffles me.
Yeah, we do. And lies are very effective and deception is very effective if we're greedy and if we're superficial in that way. But it's also, you know, those of us that talk about truth, it sounds very haughty and like, you know, it's elusive for us. It's elusive for me. I have to constantly question whether I'm being, you know, truthful to, as Emerson would say, the soul, and I'm not quite often, you know. And the battle is to peel away until you find that. And if you're lucky, you're in a situation creatively and artistically where you're allowed the time and effort to do that. And you're not very often, you know. The more practice you have at it, the quicker you can get there. But it's a house of cards, you know, this idea of creativity and truth, you know, and you build the foundation and somebody comes over and blows it over and, you know, you're lost, you know what I mean? And it's why I get very fierce in defense of that house of cards that I'm building, you know?
Well, let's move from these really light topics that we're dealing with here, truth and incest, on to two even lighter topics, serial killers and execution. We thought we would ask you about two movies in which you played a criminal defense lawyer for two very different clients. You have the one scene in Seven. And Clemency, which, I mean, I guess the characters couldn't be more different, even though they have the same job.
They had different ties as well. One had a bow tie.
Yes, the bow tie. That's right.
Okay, we'll start with him. You play a small role as John Doe's lawyer in a single but arguably pivotal scene in Seven, which was released in 1995, directed by David Fincher. Also stars Morgan Freeman, Brad Pitt, Gwyneth Paltrow, Kevin Spacey as John Doe. The screenplay was written by Andrew Kevin Walker.
Fascinating guy. You know, he wrote that. I found this out later. He wrote that when he was at Tower Records in New York City on 57th Street, I think. And he was miserable, thinking no one would ever see it, but just to expel it out of his body. He's actually a great guy. But I didn't know that till later. I read that script and hated it from hair to toenails. I hated that script so much, not because I didn't think it was brilliant, because it was. I just freaking hated it. And I didn't hide that fact, speaking of being honest. And I was on tape. David Fincher was not in the room. And I went, I'll never get this freaking role, but this is it. You know, here it is. You know, and David Fincher later told me, it was like, no one brought what you brought to that to that character. And I just can't imagine what a miserable life this lawyer must have to take on this guy as a client. but he must have been so shut off in terms of his own soul, right? So completely shut down to allow him to even get through the meeting to set up the climax that he set up in this movie, you know? That's that character.
How are you walking into that room? You know, you're representing in that film the most reprehensible person who is most certainly guilty and has essentially admitted such. You know, when you walk into that room and it's the mayor and the prosecutor and the two detectives, what is your mindset of, you know, what does this guy want?
Well, first you have to forget that you're actually walking into a room with Brad Pitt, Morgan Freeman, and Shaft. That was Richard Roundtree with Shaft. I saw the premiere of Shaft, my stepfather, in Times Square Theater. It was a big deal.
And you had Arlie Ermey, the drill sergeant.
That's right. That's right. What a wonderful man he was, and what a great actor. Yeah. So I had four pretty much titans in that room. So you have to forget that. But yeah, I imagined him getting paid. I did not imagine him being a public defender. He might have been. I don't remember which decision I made there, but he was he's definitely a bottom feeder.
And so the bow tie, was that something that you suggested, or was that a Fincher thing?
If I recall, I don't recall. I don't remember.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, Fincher is renowned for doing 88 takes of things, and you know, you have, like you mentioned, you have those sort of titans in the room, and you're in the room sitting on the couch looking rather comfortable, if I might add.
Yeah, almost smug.
And, you know, at that time, was he still doing that? And if he was, you know, what does that do to you as a performer?
Well, I'm it makes me sad that I haven't worked with David again. Not only did we do a number of takes, but we did a number of different stagings of the scene. And I had my own idea, but I was certainly yielding to the creative ways of David Fincher. And he would first have me sitting in one chair and Brad Pitt sitting there and Morgan Freeman behind the desk and a couple of people standing. The configuration that he then discovered later, which was me alone on the couch and everybody kind of facing me like a gun, like a firing squad.
Right, right.
Yep. That was discovered over the course of trial and error, and you know, just trying every possible way to do it, and then that's the way it's supposed to be in my mind. So I didn't mind that at all, and I don't remember how many takes there were, but you know, I'm the one at 4 o'clock in the morning that will do another six takes if the crew won't kill me for it. You know, I mean, I'm paid to act and I'm here to act. And why on earth wouldn't I want to do another take? So I loved working with him, and I loved the way that scene was worked out.
And so the guy you play in Clemency, Marty, couldn't be more different, you know, despite the fact that he's another lawyer in a suit.
Yeah.
We should probably tell people who haven't seen the film, first of all, go see the film. It was made in 2019, the second feature directed by Chinoye Chukwu, and stars Alfre Woodard as a death row prison warden who comes to terms with her profession, as she puts it, as she prepares to oversee the execution of a man who claims he's innocent. It stars so many performers we both love, besides Richard Schiff, Aldis Hodge, in an overwhelming performance that, for the few, comparatively few words that he actually utters.
Yeah, he's great. And Wendell Pierce is in it, and he's great.
Yeah.
Michael O'Neill, who plays the prison chaplain.
From the West Wing.
Yeah.
He was a Secret Service guy. Michael is an extraordinary actor. An extraordinary actor.
He is wonderful.
And I was so thrilled to see his work in that film, because it breaks your heart. He's just incredible.
Yeah.
Richard, this was one of the roles you told us you particularly enjoyed playing.
Yeah.
We'd love to hear how you came by this part.
I have never been more proud of a film. I was offered it. I sat down and talked to Chinoye and Bronwyn, who was the producer, and they were both so incredibly lovely and bright. And I sat down and just had the best conversation. And Chinoye is determined to be joyful. So as she describes, even working on this film, that she's determined to bring joy to the process. And she did. Just that is enough for me to say, whenever she wants me to work with her again, I will do it. And this film was gut-wrenching. And it was a culmination of work that she did in prisons for years. It was just extraordinary. The character was tough. It's someone that I recognized. I know lawyers that do this work. The nature of his career, his life's work, is such that when he wins, what he gets as a reward is that his client doesn't die. That's the best that happens in his life. And I just thought, that's remarkable.
You get to deliver this one line that really stayed with me in your spoiler alert, your final scene with Aldis.
Yes.
Where you tell him that's what this whole fucked up thing on Earth is about, to be seen and heard. And man, a line like that, back to the truth again, that strikes me as one of the opiates of acting, is to give a line like that, that if you nail it, you know it's going to resonate and it might just help.
Well, it's what it's all about. I mean, you can take it to what's happening today as we speak, you know, to not be seen, to not be felt, to not be respected, to not be heard, and it causes rage. There was one time, and I'll never forget, when I was on the street, and I was, you know, very quiet when I was young. There was a street gathering of some sort in Greenwich, down in the village, and I don't remember what it was, that somebody was playing music or somebody was dancing or who knows. And I just stopped to watch for a second, and a homeless man came up to me. I was like, oh, man, please don't. Please don't. I don't have any money. And he asked me for money for a cup of coffee or whatever it was. And I just went, no. And I kind of waved him away. And I walked away. He chased me for three blocks, screaming bloody murder. And I first of all, felt horrible. But second of all, my God, from that point on in my life, whenever someone on the street comes up to me, I look them in the eye and I'll say no, or get away, or please don't right now, or here's $5. Whatever it is, I look them in the eye. And that's ultimately what it is for all of us that don't feel seen and heard. Even in a conversation with my wife, we've been together 31 years. When it comes a moment when I don't listen to her, you can see the you can see the molecules change in the room, because she is upset that I'm not hearing, listening, respecting, you know, and seeing her. And that's what it's all about. You know, that line is so brilliant because it covers the gamut of human experience. We all just want to be seen and heard.
This is a good segue to another role of yours. One of your favorite roles that you've played is Barry from a series called Relativity. We watched a few of those episodes to prepare for this. And one of the things that stuck out to me about Barry is that he seems like a man who has spent his entire life not being seen.
Yeah.
And he's trying constantly with sort of these different schemes, these different, you know, there's a very sort of Arthur Miller Death of a Salesman thing to him, where it's like, he's just got to, you know, get that one trifecta kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And so I did want to talk a little bit about Barry and specifically, you know, how you saw him, his relationship with his son. He lives with his father, whom he takes care of. And being that that's such an important role to you, I was curious, you know, how you came to Barry.
Well, it was a show created by Ed Zwick, and or produced anyway by Ed Zwick, and Jason Kadams, who went on to quite a prolific career as a TV writer, was the writer on that show. Mm. And his dad, Jason's dad, played my dad. But I went and auditioned for that back in the early 90s, and no one knew who I was. And fascinating thing is that a week before, I had a reading group where we all got together and read plays and scripts and stuff. And some lovely actors were a part of that group. And somebody decided they wanted to read Death of a Salesman. And they gave me Willie to read. And it's like, why am I always playing the old guy? I was like young back then. Why can't I play Biff? And, you know, Lee J. Cobb was 29 when he originally played Willie Loman.
Wow.
But it's always been a favorite play of mine. I used to listen to it at Lincoln Center Library and read along with it and always end up in tears. But back then, I had never seen it live. It was already a favorite role, you know. I still would love to play that role someday. Anyway, that was in my blood when I went into audition. All I saw was Willie Loman there. So I went in and I said to Ed Zwick and Marshall Herskowitz, who was his partner, and I said, I am way too young for this. And they go, well, just read it. And I go, okay, but I'm way too young for this. And I read it and they go, well, we've been auditioning people for a long time and you're the first person to bring it to life. And I think it was because of the fact that I had just worked on Death of a Salesman. And they took me to network. You know, you have to do a test for the network. All the other people, Lisa Edelstein was one. She played my daughter.
Right.
From
the pilot of The West Wing, too.
That's right. And
and Devin Gummersall, who I just rewatched My So-Called Life, and he had made his debut as Brian Krakow, same producers, that
Devin,
show.
Devin, his brother worked with Marshall for years later. Devin's a sweet kid. And anyway, I was the only actor that ABC did not want. And Ed Zwick spent a week, called me and said, it's going to be a battle, but we're not giving up. I heard that they wanted Elliot Gould to play that role. They wanted someone with a name. And he is a lot older. And Ed Zwick just held out and won the battle. So I did that role, and not only were they great and wrote these beautiful scenes, but they let me go to do The Lost World right in the middle of it all. So they were accommodating in every possible way. And I loved that character because he was a version of Willie Loman. But there was something so touching about him because he wasn't aware of himself. And I often have to play very smart people because people, for some reason, are under the illusion or delusion that I'm smart. And it's only because I don't talk a lot normally. I'm talking a lot now. But and because of my silence, people assume I'm smart. And that's always been the case. So I was so thrilled to play this character who didn't know any better and in his mind tried his best. You know, this was his best, and this is all he had, and he didn't know how wrong it was, you know, and that was very touching to me.
There's a scene early on in the show where you have to go to your son, and you have to admit to him that you have not been a good father, and that you're basically out of your depth in your dealings with your family, and you have to say to him that you need his help to do something. That scene for me with you was just incredible. You know, this admission. I grew up with, you know, parents. I'm a child of divorce, I guess is how to say it. And so, you know, being exposed to that and seeing sort of my parents arguing about things when I was a kid. But I'm just wondering, you know, did you have children already by the time you were doing that or no?
I had one tiny little kid. He was barely walking, my son Gus, so I didn't have that experience yet. No.
So that's even more interesting to me. So when you're coming at a moment like that, where you have to play this man who's very sort of put upon and has probably, you know, failed at many, many things in his life, and now he has to admit to his own child that he's failed. How do you come to that moment?
Sadly, I think he was manipulative because he didn't know any other way.
Right.
That's the sadness of it. It's not like, hey, I've just come to this epiphany that I'm a shitty father and I should, you know, we should have this conversation and, you know, talk it out. And I think the truth came out because he had nothing else. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He had no other tool.
Yeah.
Sounds like parenthood.
Yeah, well, okay, there you go.
So this was a show that ran for one season on ABC, and as you said, produced by Marshall Herskovitz and Edzwick, who had made another show that I revere, even though I was way too young to be watching 30-something when it was on.
Right.
It just stayed with me, again, for that same truth you're talking about, which I saw when I started watching Relativity to speak to you. It was like rejuvenating myself because the show is so almost so innocent and like prudish when you look at it now compared to what we watch on TV these days. You know, I mean, the nudity, the violence, the degree to which we see that. And you've said that that was an element of why this show was, of what you look back on this as one of your favorite roles, or actually, I think you've said it was your favorite role.
Yeah.
Was that there was that the show didn't need any of that. It was human drama. It was relationships. Again, family. So was that, I mean, was that part of why that role stands out still as your favorite?
Probably. That's well described. I mean, I don't think I thought of it that way at the time, but that was what was happening. It was an exploration into family and relationships, an honest exploration. You know, Edzwick is a very smart but very kind of lovely human being. And that's the kind of work that he's done before and since. You know, My So-Called Life was a wonderful show, as was 30-something. And I just think 30-something is my Timmy Busfield kissed my wife before she was my wife.
Well.
Timmy, Timmy and we later worked on The West Wing together. But I
was going to say he also kissed C.J. Craig. So,
I don't have rights on C.J. But yeah, that's very much a part of how lovely it was to work with those people. And Jason obviously is a wonderful writer as well. And they respected me. They respected. They didn't have no reason to respect me. There was just an appreciation for the work that I was trying to attain on that set. I mean, so much so that there were lighting. I used to pace around the set, and I would always know when the kind of the sound of the set would settle, and I knew they were ready. So the ADs never had to get me. I would just come out, and one scene, it was with Devin that I remember, and it was on his bed in his room. The soundstage was just wide open. I remember this intimate, tight scene it was supposed to be, but yeah. the open wall where the cameras were, it was vast when you looked out there. And there was Claire Danes crouching and watching. She was visiting the set. And I didn't know who she was. I had not seen My So-Called Life at that point. And I remember seeing her outside, and I asked somebody, I think I asked Devin, I said, who was that? And he told me, and she's remarkable. And he went, yeah. I had no idea who she was, but she had something about her that was just extraordinary. But anyway, she was crouching and watching. And I sat down on the bed, and I noticed the camera was over kind of Devin's head to me, as if I was going to speak to Devin directly. And I said to the director's name, I can't remember, but he was great. He was a constant presence on that show, and I forget his name. But I turned to him and I said, are you going to have another shot of me? And he went, no. He just kind of shook his head. And I said, well, just so you know, I'm not going to turn to him ever. And he went, okay. And they relit and they replaced the camera. And shot it the way I had told him I was going to do it. And it was a choice that it was, you know, this guy can't look him in the eye and he can't say these things to his face. And it's an experience that I'd had where someone in my family sat on the edge of my bed, drunk, and basically did, spoke a monologue for about an hour and never looked at me, and then got up and went to his room and went to sleep. And that was kind of what I was drawing from. And and they just complete respect for what my vision of what I wanted to do. And that's why I love it so much. So it was not only the experience of that, but it was the nature of the writing of it and working with people who were same-minded, you know, and that's why it was extraordinary.
So one season on that set to many, many seasons in The West Wing. We would love to ask you a few things about that very small role in your career, if you wouldn't mind. No. When I look back on that entire series, there's one scene in one episode that I think is maybe is my most memorable of the entire series. And I went back and rewatched it, and I still think that. And it's season 4, episode 22, commencement, and it's when you take Andy to see the house.
Oh.
And she tells you that she can't be with you because you're too sad. And she tells Toby. Going back and scrutinizing it, you know, Toby bumps his head on the chandelier. He's so nervous. It's just not the man we've seen, and yet it is the man we've seen for 4 seasons. And I wanted to hear you break that one down and whether that stand out for you.
No, I don't think of that scene as one that comes to mind, but I remember it vividly. And I loved working with Kathleen York, who played my ex Andy.
Yeah.
And I remember how she played it completely, you know, shocked at what I had done. I blindfolded her, right? And brought her into the house, and the vulnerability of that. I just let that live. The vulnerability of thinking you're doing the right thing, kind of fingers crossed behind your back that her reaction will be in line with my desire. I just remember the vulnerability of it was extraordinary. It felt extraordinary. And she was great. I just remember every move and every tick and every, you know, like stunned expression that she brought to that scene.
Was her character right about your character?
I don't think that sad is a word that came to his mind. But when she said it, I think it rang true. And that was devastating. That was a devastating moment for him.
That whole, and then the whole episode after that too. I mean, it's when he becomes a father. There's just so much happening. I'm geeking out a little bit, as I knew I would, but that just, I don't know why that one really stuck with me as much as it did.
Well, she must've been really big in that house.
Sure. Well, her water breaks. She leaves the house and stands out in her,
oh,
and her
God,
water breaks.
That's right. Okay.
So in that episode, you guys are off to the hospital.
Yeah, that makes the scene with the babies with the hats much more poignant than, and I remember, cause I don't,
yeah.
That's the same episode?
I don't know what happened, because you guys always did 22, but that season there were 23.
Yeah, I think the 23rd episode was a special that year. So I think this all happened in episode 22. But whatever, I that makes that baby with the hats even more kind of painful mm-hmm. and beautiful.
Well, and yeah, and you also have that conversation with John Spencer's Leo, where you basically express to him that you don't think you have sort of the gene to be, you know, maybe a father or to be that kind of person that looks with love on your child. And Spencer tells you, you know, yes, you do.
Yeah.
But you don't realize that you do until that moment in the hospital with the hats, which is just phenomenal. So
I have to say that scene with John, of course, we all adored him, and he was such a phenomenally talented man. And a wonderful, wonderful actor, and loved every bit of it, loved acting, loved the costumes, loved the award shows, loved the makeup trailer. He spent hours in there gossiping with everybody for, you know, I just loved that man. But the greatest compliment I've ever received was from that scene when he and I are sitting in his office. And at one point, John just looked at me up like surprised. And he went, I have no idea who's on camera. and, you know, it was the greatest compliment to me and I to him, because we were so involved with moment to moment with each other. It just did not matter where the camera was. That's why I loved working with him. It's why I loved working with Allison in particular. We always were either the same or better off camera than we were on. And with John, you just forgot. You just, I mean, he said it, but I always felt it. You just forgot. It was just irrelevant, you know, because you were just going to do it again, and it was going to be different or better or just as alive or whatever. And I'll never forget that. That was the scene where he said that.
What moment for Toby for you was a pivotal moment?
There's a couple for me. It's an episode that people talk about a lot because it's their favorite episode. It was voted their favorite episode along with the pilot. And that's in Excelsis Deo. But there's a moment under the bridge when I'm talking to the homeless man. And I decided to make this make sense for me to say at one point to the man who was not understanding me, I'm a very powerful man. And I'm so embarrassed that's what comes out of my mouth next. And I end up putting my hand to my head as I'm saying it.
Yeah. To your forehead, yeah.
And I realized that's defining. That's a defining moment for who this guy is. Someone who is embarrassed by his position and by having to say it out loud. And I remember being so enthralled with the fact that I discovered that moment that wherever the camera was for the next 7 different angles, I made sure I repeated that exactly the way I discovered it. And the other defining moment was in a bar with the woman who says, "Are you one of those political operatives?" And I say, "Yeah." And at one point she goes, "Have you ever won?" This is a flashback, by the way. So he still hasn't ever won. When we shot it, this wasn't written in, but I remember taking what was probably almost 30 seconds, which is in film time, about 7 days, to think about whether I had actually ever won, and realizing in that moment that I hadn't. And then I say no. And I say it with surprise. I think I say I know or something. And that was another defining moment for me, in that he's never taken on a cause that has been victorious, and B, he never gave it a second thought. And I thought that was fascinating.
When you're on a show for as long as you were on the West Wing and you talk about, you know, being with that family, when you're around each other that much and you're in the thick of it, how much of you starts to be Toby because, you know, Aaron seeing you and talking to you and having conversations about your experience? Like, when does the line completely blur at a certain point?
Way too much. How much of me is in that cat? Way too much. As any writer, you know, worth their salt is going to draw from what they see in front of them, A. And B, I showed up at the audition. I had worked with Tommy before, Tommy Schlamme. And I brought something that no one had brought to it. And Aaron went, "Wait, maybe we should go this path." And I think the nature of who Toby was definitely a lot of it as we evolved was drawn from Aaron getting to know me. He did with Josh, and John Spencer had an issue with substance abuse, which was common knowledge. And, Aaron turned it into a phenomenal storyline, that episode, which he won an Emmy. And I was that way on set in those days. I was very intent upon finding a better version of what we were doing. I was not easily satisfied. I insisted upon rehearsal, and I corrected guest directors to the ways that we were used to on the set. I became, you know, Tommy appointed me kind of unofficially as the policeman of the set. Anyway, the point of all that was, Aaron, I think, picked up on how important the integrity of the work was to me, Richard. And I think more and more he imbued Toby with that kind of quality. And somehow Toby started to evolve into the conscience of the White House, as people have said. I read this beautiful piece recently where somebody wrote about my work as Toby in the West Wing.
Is it possible to say something new about the West Wing at this point from your perspective?
Well, I sent this article to Aaron because he kind of
really
caught the relationship. It wasn't like a New York Times critic. It was just a guy who writes stuff about television.
Oh, now I really want to give him a shout out, whoever he is.
Let me see if I can find it. From, I'm so bad. I don't know how people find these old tweets that people, I can't even find my own tweets. This is fascinating. Is this going to be on the podcast, all of this stuff?
Well, I think it's kind of cool if you saw something new about this character, which I think is probably hard, and it was written by not some, you know, highfalutin critic or something.
No, yeah.
But a person making an observation, and then it made its way to Aaron through you. I think it would be really cool to give whoever that writer was a little airtime.
Well,
sure.
I have it here. It's a site that is 25 years later, and even though The West Wing isn't 25 years later, this guy wrote an article because I guess he couldn't wait another 4 or 5 years to write this. And it's called "The Lovable Difficulty and Inner Turmoil of Toby Ziegler." And it's written by a guy named Clay Dockery. That's a very long article. I mean, he writes that Toby's irascible, uncompromising, constantly on the edge of being overwhelmed. There is always at least one character in each Sorkin show who, for more than any other, is the avatar for Sorkin in some way. It seems clear that Toby is that character, who embodies how Sorkin would see himself in the story. There was something about the way that I approached Sorkin's language and his material that I think was a little bit different than others, in that the other actors sometimes would talk about how you have to ride the wave of the language. And I never felt that that was the case. And I always felt that there were tendrils underneath what he was writing that was much deeper than that surface eloquence and the fun and the music of his language and the quips and the jokes. And I always felt there was something really dark in the underbelly of that language. That's a mixed metaphor. But and I saw a much darker version of his language than, say, you know, Rob or Brad. And rightfully so, because their characters, I think, had the optimism and the kind of frivolity, you know. So I often say that if Sorkin's West Wing was a symphony, it needed a darker, baser sound. And the instrument that I chose was the bassoon, because when the music stopped for a half a second or more, if you will, or rested in some way, that's when you could hear the bassoon, which you realized was playing all along.
Well, I think that's why that episode 22 stayed with me, because that's what it seemed like. It seemed like everybody else shut the hell up for a minute and Toby was front and center, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly one way to look at it.
No offense to the rest of the family.
No, but I think that's what Aaron reacted to. And that was the gift that Aaron gave me, the most personal and the most difficult aspects of who he is as a human being. And I think he recognized that I was digging down for that stuff. I saw it already, which is why my character became a little bit darker than the others.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say that he gave me all of his most difficult issues, because clearly, you know, the alcoholism that Leo was dealing with and the PTSD that Josh was dealing with all comes from the same kind of, you know, nerve center of Aaron Sorkin.
Toby's always so measured and so sort of soft until he's presented with a person who, you know, really pushes his buttons. And then it's, you know, you raise out of it for just a moment, but then it's almost like he feels terrible that he's allowed somebody to get under his skin that way. Those are the moments that really register for me as well as a viewer, because I'm interested in this guy who seems to be trying very hard not to reveal much of himself. And yet in certain instances, he can't help but do just exactly that.
A few things about when someone reveals who they are, you know. Arthur Miller, he writes about men who have no choice but to act the way that they do. In other words, their paradigm system has forced them into the corner of these final actions. You know, Willie Loman killing himself at the end of the play, and, you know, what's his name from View from the Bridge having to commit murder and all those kinds of things. And I've always taken that to account. And when acting, one of the things that I loved to discover about it was, you know, when you come to a monologue, for instance, you have to be compelled to speak that much. You know, Mark Antony had a reason to give that speech. You know, he couldn't just get up and chat. You know, he had a motive, he had a necessity to do it. He was driven by moral compulsion or whatever he was driven to, you know, I haven't really studied that role, but you know what I mean? I was so in love with that concept around the time of The West Wing that, especially for that character, especially considering the import and the gravity of the work that he was doing, where lives were at stake, you know, people would live or die, lose their home or not, or get medical care or not, or eat or not, based on the decisions of that group of people and that president. And so I started to fall in love with the idea that Toby didn't speak until he had to. And I would often go to Aaron and say, this monologue is not Toby, it's Josh, or it's Leo. And he would go, you're giving away a 2-page monologue? And I'd go, yeah, it's not me. And I don't think he'd ever come across that before. And it was because of the fact that I did not want to speak unless it was necessary. And it gave input, you know, so often I was the quiet one in scenes. And Tommy would tell me that he would sometimes not know how to end a scene. And then he realized he hadn't seen Toby in a while. And he would see me reacting to what was happening. And he would go, that's how I get out of this scene. And I'd cut mm-hmm. Toby.
That's amazing.
That's the end. Yeah.
That was a happy byproduct of that. But that's because I was working with people who were paying attention.
It's interesting that you said that, because Shannon and I were talking recently. I haven't directed a lot, but I was telling her that my instinct as a director is that if I've cast the right person, I don't actually really talk about what we're doing before we do it. I just want to see what the actor wants to do. In other words, you know, you get on the set and I don't direct before I see the first take, you know, because my feeling is that if I've hired the right person, they know the character, they should know what the intent is. And then I just want to see what they're doing. And that's sort of, you know, what you just said made me think of that. But I, you know, we've taken up a lot of your time and we are extremely grateful. And I just have to tell you, I still pinch myself that I was a producer on something that you were in. Because, you know, the idea for this show, this podcast, was to talk to people whose work has affected us. And you are certainly one of those people. So I want to say on behalf of Shannon and myself, and hopefully our audience, thank you very much.
What if I don't want to end it?
I mean, I still have 3 or 4 pages of questions that we didn't get.
very, very kind of you guys. Very sweet of you to say, and I appreciate that. And it's always nice to feel like you've affected people and that they appreciate what you do. And so thank you for that. And I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. If you want to get to those 3 or 4 pages some other time, I'm happy to come back.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Richard. Thank you.
Same here.
Character is dedicated to the memory of our friend Drago Sumanja, whose life and work inspire ours.
The show is produced by us. Shannon edits our episodes, and we have technical support from sound wizard Tim Skoke.
Our stunning original score was composed by Academy Award winner Dario Marianelli.
If you enjoy the show, put in a good word wherever you get your podcasts and track us down on Twitter @podcharacter for future updates. Most importantly, thanks for listening.